reading at 2 Kings chapter 4 and verse 8. And it fell on a day that Elisha passed to Shunem. There was a great woman, and she constrained him to eat bread. And so it was that as oft as he passed by, he turned in thither to eat bread. We're looking at this encounter between Elisha and this Shunammite woman. A passage I'm sure all of you are very familiar with. And my title for this evening's message is Earnest and Feelingful Prayer. And praying for souls, which you will come to in a moment. But we begin here at verse 8. Elisha is on his way, most likely from Samaria to Mount Carmel. It was a journey he often did. And he's actually, Samaria was in the northwest of a part, northwest of Samaria, an agricultural village or town. And he had to probably take a detour to get there. It's not quite sure why he went to Shunem. He could have gone a more direct route to Mount Carmel. But obviously in the Lord's providence, he was to meet this woman. And when he arrives at the town, at his village, he's invited to a meal by this woman, a great woman. A great woman, great in the sense that, yes, she is somewhat wealthy. Great also in the sense maybe she was of some standing in the community, in the village, the town where she was. But as well, already we can say, as we, with some forethought, that she is also great in other ways. She's great in kindness, we'll see. She's great in hospitality. She opens her door to this unknown man, a prophet. She's great in contentment. She's at rest. She's learned the art of contentment. And especially, she is great in faith. And that comes through in these chapters. These are the things, isn't it, we also want to excel in. Faith, contentment, hospitality, and so on. But Elisha wasn't so keen, it seems, to take up that invitation. He wasn't one for fancy food. He wasn't one to go in and eat and dine, probably in a rich person's house. He was quite content with the simple things of life. And he does appear hesitant, but she's importunate. She won't give up. She constrains him to come into her house and eat a meal and have a meal together. And he yields to her importunity. And it came to pass, well, he must have so enjoyed the time that he spent in the house. I'm sure, apart from the meal, the fellowship that they were having together. And he found that in this woman and her husband, that there was some spiritual communications and fellowship. And so he, whenever in future days he passed by that way, well, he was more than happy to turn in to receive some refreshment physically, and also some spiritual fellowship. And it's a lesson already for us here, the need, or the joy of hospitality, of opening our home, to be given. Romans 12, verse 3 says, we are to be given to hospitality. 1 Peter 4, verse 9, use hospitality without one to another without grudging. And one of the actual qualifications even of an elder is he must be a lover of hospitality. So what a lot of good can be done when we open our homes or have a meal together. We have our fellowship meals as well in the church once a month. And that's also a good time for us to invite others. Maybe also we should do a bit of constraining. Sometimes people turn down our offers or invitations. Maybe we should constrain them, not give up so easily. Because so many barriers can be broken down, and so much good can be done just over a meal, even together. And verse 9, she goes on to say, after a number of visits, she says to her husband, "Behold now, I perceive that this is and holy man of God, which passeth by us continually. She discerned something different in Elisha. There were probably some people who were prophets, but prophets only in name. They had the title, but here she sees, after the regular visits, there's a consistency in Elisha, consistency in his character. There's a holiness in his character. He is a holy man of God and a genuine man of God, one who really knows the Lord and follows the Lord. Well, that must be true by us as well, isn't it? There must be a genuine holiness to us. We are justified by faith in the Lord. And when we are justified, God declares us holy. God declares us not guilty. It's a judicial act, a judicial declaration. But sanctification is where we are actually made holy, where we are changed, and where we are becoming holy. So on the one sense, yes, we are declared holy and we're accepted by God, but also we want to see holiness in people's lives, in our lives, and a growing holiness. Not that we want people to see that we are holy. We ourselves, we recognize our imperfections. We recognize our failings. But we want to be growing in holiness. That means consistency in our walk with the Lord. Growing in kindness, growing in gentleness, growing in patience, meekness, being able to take it when others speak ill of us, being able to respond in the right way when we are misjudged or something. That's meekness, and not to respond back in a terrible way. Well, there are so many ways in which we can improve in holiness. Well, she noticed this, and she says to her husband, he's a true man of God. Verse 10, let's make a little chamber, I pray thee, on the wall, and let us set for him there a bed and a table and a stool and a candlestick, and it shall be when he cometh to us that he shall turn in thither. She comes up with this idea. It's good to have people who've got ideas in the church. Not all of us are good at coming up with ideas, but it's good when it does. And she makes this recommendation to her husband to build a simple room, a simple chamber for the prophet. I pray thee, on the wall, on the upper chamber is the suggestion. And what she seems to be saying is, let's build him a wall on the roof of the house. The roof, the houses in those days, they were flat roofs, and they had the stairs would go by the side of the house, leading to the top of the roof. It was a place, probably one of the favorite place in the house for the Israelites. They could rest and relax on the top. And she proposes, let's build a room for him there, which is enclosed by walls, so that he can have his own privacy. He can go in and out as when he comes and not be worried about us downstairs. So it's quite a proposal, isn't it? It's a costly one on one hand, and yet on the other hand, it's also a sacrificial one, because they're giving up their space, they're giving up this favorite place of theirs for the sake of the prophet, and whenever he's there, that he can use it. They're willing to deny themselves for his benefit. And also we see the kind of furniture that is going to be placed in this room. Nothing extravagant, nothing luxurious, just very simple things. A bed, a table, a stool, a lampstand, that's all that's going to be placed. She already knows that Elisha doesn't want the luxury things and luxury items. She can already see in his life, he's a very simple man who lives a very simple lifestyle. If she had decorated it in a very fancy way, well, he wouldn't have liked that. He wouldn't have been so comfortable in there. And he lives very simply. And again, a lesson for each one of us to also follow. But then, verse 11, on one day, it fell on a day that he came thither, and he turned into the chamber and lay there. And he said to Gehazi, his servant, call the Shunammite. And when he had called her, she stood before him. He wants to reward her in some way. She has done, gone out of her way to make this room for him, to be a blessing to him. And now she, in a sense, deserves a prophet's reward. And so he asked Gehazi to call this Shunammite woman. Now, if you just carry on reading, we may get a little bit confused with what's happening here, because he says to call her, and then it looks as if Elisha is speaking through Gehazi to the woman, as if he's not speaking directly to her. If we just carry on reading verse 13 and 14, and then verse 15, it doesn't make sense, because he says call her again, but she's already there. So just a little technical point, I think it would be better if you put parenthesis around verse 13 and verse 14. So verse 12, he says call her, but before he said call her, the dialogue between in verses 13 and 14 between Elisha and Gehazi takes place. So we'll just look at that verse. Verse 13, Elisha says, "This say unto her, go and," he says to his servant Gehazi, "go and say to her, you've been very careful, you've been very anxious to prepare this place for us. You put in a lot of effort and time and expense to prepare this with great care. Now what can be done for thee? Wouldst thou be spoken for to the king or to the captain of the host? Is somebody troubling you? Is one of the neighbors troubling you? Do you have any disputes over the land?" And this time Elisha seems to have had some connection with Jehoram, the king, and or with the captain of the host. And he is willing to speak on her behalf to help her resolve any difficulty. But she doesn't need it. She will later, because we come across her again. And at that time, she had left the land. She had left because of a famine. And when she came back to the king, she needed the king's help to regain her land. But now she doesn't. And she answered, Gehazi, I dwell among my own people. I'm very content with where I am. I don't need anything else. I need nothing. And furthermore, she's saying, I didn't build this extension to get any reward. I just built it to be a blessing, for it to be a blessing to you. She's indifferent to a reward. And then Elisha says to Gehazi, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi said, well, her husband is old, and she has no children. She has no child. And then verse 15, he said, call her, which is the same call as in verse 12. Call her. And when he had called her, she stood in the door, and he gives her this promise. About this season, according to this time of life, the time of life, thou shalt embrace a son. You are going to have a son. But she says, nay, my Lord, thou man of God, do not lie unto thine handmaiden. That means she's saying there, do not allow me to get so excited with such a promise. Do not stir up my emotions and my hopes, and then only for it to be dashed again in pieces. And that's the idea here. Do not lie unto thine handmaid. But Elisha was giving her a true promise from the Lord. And he'd obviously prayed about it before he told her these things, and he gave her this word. And true enough, it came to pass. Verse 17, the woman conceived and bare a son at that season that Elisha had said unto her, according to the time of life. And then we move on to the next section. The child is now grown, but how old is he? Well, it seems he is young enough to run out to the field where his father and the reapers are, and he's also young enough to be carried by a young lad, a young man, to his mother, and he's young enough as well, short enough, we should say, maybe, to sit on his mother's knees. So he must be of primary age of some sort. But here, this little child ran out to his father in the field. When they were reaping, the hottest time apparently of the year, and there in the middle of the field at some point, he cries to his father, my head, it seems he's had sunstroke of some sort, and come down feeling the terrible headache. And so he's carried to his mother, and his mother tries to soothe him and alleviate his symptoms, and hoping, no doubt, that he, praying that he recovers. But verse 20, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. And amazingly, look at verse 21. There's, with amazing self-control, this mother of this child, her only child who just died, seems to show no emotion, seems to show no reaction, no despair. She sort of holds back her despair and takes the child and lays him not on her own bed, but the bed of the man of God, and shut the door upon him and went out. It's as if she has already come up very quickly with a plan in her own mind. She had this child was given to her by the Lord in faith, and she seems to also be thinking in a very faithful kind of way that this can't be the end. So she seems to be entertaining a secret hope that all is not lost, that there is hope, and because she knows that she has somebody that she can run to Elisha, and to ask for help. But such amazing composure she seems to display in such a terrible crisis. And a little bit of a lesson there also for us, that when we meet with crises in our lives, and very quickly we are prone to respond in a despairing way, and with all things are against me, we cry out, and we feel that there's no way out. But we should remember that we have a God that we can run to. We shouldn't collapse, but also think in faith and express our faith. We have a friend in heaven. We are not without hope as believers. We have a friend in heaven, a God in heaven, that we may run to for help and for deliverance. And so we shouldn't act as if we are an unbeliever. But verse 22, she calls her husband and says, send me, I pray thee, one of the young asses. I want to run to the man of God and then return. And he queries it, how come you're going today? It's not a special feast. It's not a new moon or a Sabbath day, which suggests that they used to go to see Elisha on these special teaching, seems like teaching days, festival days. And she again remarks, look at these words, it shall be well. It shall be well. In fact, in the Hebrew, it's just one word, shalom, peace. That's all she says. And it's a remarkable answer as well. She doesn't want to trouble her husband on one hand, but it's also an answer of faith, that she thinks it shall be well, even though her son at the moment is dead. Well, she saddles an ass and says to her servant, drive, go forward, slack not thy riding, go as fast as you can. And she made her way to the man of God, to Mount Carmel. No short journey, some 15 or 20 miles on that ass. So it would have taken 2 or 3 hours for her to get there. And it came to pass when the man of God saw her from afar off, he recognized that it's the Shunammite woman. And he said to his servant Gehazi, verse 26, run now, I pray thee, to meet her, and say unto her, is it well with thee? Is it well with thy husband? Is it well with the child? And once again she answered, it is well. She didn't really want to tell him, because he's just a servant. She wants to go to see Elisha. He's the one that she has come to see. He's the one that she has come to unburden herself to. And so when she does come to Elisha, she catches him by the feet. She's and holds tightly to her. She can hold back her distress no longer. Gehazi thinks she's being disrespectful to him, and so comes to thrust her away. And Elisha said, let her alone, for her soul is vexed within her, and the Lord hath hid it from me and hath not told me. Let her alone. Leave her alone. Just like we can think of those, that woman who came to the Syrophoenician woman, who came to the Lord. Her daughter was much vexed by a demon, and they wanted to get rid of her. Send her away. Send her away. She's troubling. And the Lord wouldn't send her away, and she wouldn't go until she obtained help from the Lord. But here as well, the man of God said, leave her alone. Her soul is deeply troubled. She's in great sorrow, and I don't know what it is that has happened to her. And even Elisha doesn't know everything. He's the prophet of God, but even such things sometimes are hidden from him. Different from our Lord, different from the great prophet, the Savior, who knows all things about us. Nothing is hid from him. Everything about us is known to him. As we saw on Sunday, Lord, Peter said, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest, he said, that I love thee. Well, here Elisha didn't know. And then she unveils to him. She tells him, verse 28, did I desire a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? She again says these things. Immediately, Elisha tells his servant, gird up thy loins, take my staff in thy hand, go thy way. If thou meet any man, salute him not. And if any salute thee, answer him not again, and lay my staff upon the face of the child. And he does that. Off he goes. But the mother won't go with Gehazi. She wants Elisha to come along as well. Verse 30, as the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee. And he arose and followed her. Well, Gehazi went on, laid the staff, which was the symbol of the prophet, upon the face of the child. But there was neither voice nor hearing. It had no effect. Wherefore he went again to meet him and told him, saying, the child is not awaked. And then Elisha comes into the house and he goes up into the room, shuts the door behind him, and it's just him and the child, the dead child in the room, and he prays unto the Lord for this dead child, just like Elijah had prayed for the widow's son. And he went up and lay upon the child and put his mouth upon his mouth and his eyes upon his eyes. He didn't do this He did this in order, I should say. First he lay upon the child. Then he put his mouth upon his mouth, because the size, they were different in size, of course. Then he put his eyes upon his eyes, and his hands upon his hands. And he stretched himself upon the child, trying to do, as it were, trying to express his great concern, his great feeling, his great care for this child. Whom he has known even from very young, and whom no doubt he has taken an interest in, and would be also a great loss to him. But he's thinking especially about the family that his mother and his father, and he stretches himself out upon the child, and the flesh of the child waxed warm. And of course, in these verses, we have a picture of praying for souls, and how we should pray for our unconverted friends, our unconverted relatives, our unconverted neighbors or workmates whom we are concerned for, to be much in prayer for them, with a feeling for prayer, just like Elisha has here. Not a cold kind of prayer, but we think about their situation. Not just, Lord, save them, but we are thinking about what kind, about their situation. What would happen to them if they were lost, if they perished, those friends, eternally? Well, these things move us. We don't want that to happen. Maybe we could think about praying for souls as if we are praying for our unconverted children, our own unconverted children. We seem to put more effort or more concern and more feeling into those prayers for our own children. And we should also maybe think like that when we're praying for unconverted friends, to have real desire for their salvation and deep concern, just like Elisha has here. And the flesh of the child, we read, waxed warm. There's some sign of life. It's not back to life. It hasn't opened its eyes yet. It's not breathing yet. But it's some indication that there is something happening. It's sometimes like that with those we are trying to reach. You may see some indication suddenly that they are turning to the Lord. Maybe they warm to the gospel, or they begin to ask questions, or maybe they're listening a little bit more attentively. They're not saved yet, they're not born again yet, they're not come to repentance yet, but they're giving some indications. So we mustn't give up praying at that point. We must, like Elisha, continue to pray for them. We're hopeful, we're encouraged by what we see, but we must persist in it. Verse 35, this is what he does. He goes down, walks in the house to and fro, and then up again to the room, and stretches himself upon him, and the child sneezed seven times, and the child opened his eyes. He comes back to life, and then he calls Gehazi, and says, call the Shunammite, and he presents the son back to the Shunammite, a woman who bows herself to the ground, ever grateful, very grateful to the Lord, to God, who has done these things. It's not Elisha. It's not Elisha's warmth. It's not Elisha's actions. It's the Lord who has done these things, and the Lord who has brought this person to life again. And so a lesson also for us here when we're praying for souls. Think of the arguments again when you're praying. Pray, Lord, if this person is saved, what a lot of good will come. What a lot of sins they will stop doing. Lord, if this person is saved, they will become a better person. They may bring others to you. Lord, if this person is saved, their lives will contribute to thy glory. There will be trophies of thy grace. These are the things, arguments that we can sort of use with the Lord, to plead with him earnestly to save those that we are praying for here, even in the church. And so pray with friends, with desire, and pray with earnest prayer and longing for the salvation of those unbelieving friends who come across our way with great concern. And we trust that the Lord also will hear our prayers and will bring some of these friends through to life again and to faith and repentance in him.